produce very heavy rainfall as well as gusty winds and hail. So once again, the flash flood watch in effect from 4 this afternoon till 9 tomorrow morning. Right now, humidity 100%, 75 degrees in Racine, 70 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. And I'm very, very excited to be speaking for this portion of WGTD's morning show with documentarian Tamar Tal-Anati, responsible for a lovely film that is about to air on the PBS series POV, or Point of View. As many of you know, the series POV gathers together intriguing, compelling films from all around the world. For the most part, made by independent filmmakers on a wide array of different topics. This particular film, Shalom Italia, follows three elderly Jewish brothers as they journey from Israel to Italy, back to a place where their family home once existed. And they are, in a sense, not only revisiting a geographical place, but also revisiting a chapter from their own fairly distant past. And it's a remarkable story, which also says a great deal about the way in which we understand our own personal stories, our own family history. It's a story also about kindness extended in the moments of great difficulty and danger. It's a very, very intriguing story and a beautifully crafted film. And Tamar Tal-Anati is responsible for it on several different levels, I believe, as its producer and director and writer and editor in all kinds of different respects. This is very much her film. Tamar Tal-Anati, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Happy to be talking with you. A quick word, if you would, first of all, about your life as a filmmaker, as a documentarian. How did you become interested in doing this kind of thing?
I was actually studying photography. I was a photographer for many years, and I became into the film business. I ran into my first film. And when I met her, it was a 96-year-old lady owning an old photography shop in Israel. And when I heard her story, I felt that I must tell her story. And I just started doing it by filming her. And years later, it became to be my first documentary called Life in Stills. And actually, this was my first entrance to the documentary world. And when I finished with that first film, I felt that I want to continue. I enjoyed, and I was so much challenged by doing this and inspired. So I was really looking to do another one. And I started to make all kinds of research and thinking what would be my next film when I was sitting in just a regular dinner at my father and mother-in-law, the parents of Nadav, my husband, and while we're having a regular dinner, his father announced that him and his older brothers decided to go and search for the cave they were hiding in 70 years ago in Italy. And when he was saying that, I was like, what? Where are you going? What are you talking about? I never heard about this story. And I immediately felt that this is the next film. Knowing him and his two older brothers, Emmanuel and Andrea, I realized I could have made, sorry, I could have made a film about each one of them. And now I have this amazing opportunity of having the three of them together in the same journey, and I immediately told him he has to ask their permission that I will join them and a cinematographer will join them to this journey. And this is how this Shalom Italia was born, in really just another day.
Right. And in a sense, quite by accident, but what a happy accident it is. So at this point, we should probably explain a little more about kind of the backstory of what happened to your father's family and I mean, father-in-law, including his two brothers, when they lived in Italy. And of course, we're taking ourselves back to the dark days of the Second World War. First of all, how is it that they lived in Italy? What brought the family there in the first place? Or is that where the family's roots had always been?
Yeah, the family, it's my father-in-law family had at least seven generation back in Italy. And they were very involved in the Italian culture and political society, and in 39, when the Nazi law began to arrived to Italy, they started to feel it very very intensively. The older brother Emmanuel was kicked out of school, and Andrea, right after him, was also kicked out of school, and they were not allowed to work. They had to sell their. They had the father was an architect, and they had an architecture office, and had to sell it. And slowly, slowly, they lost all their rights. And one night, a friend knocked on the door very late at night, and he was a policeman. He came with no uniform and told them that he just saw their whole family names in the list that going tomorrow morning on the train to Auschwitz. And he told them, you have to run right now. Don't wait for the morning. Just run away from your house right now. And this is how this all escape started. When they left Florence, they left their home and ran. And the first place they ran into is their summer house in the village, and from that point, starting a few years of being on the run, we're talking about two parents, two grandmothers, and four children, four boys.
And of course, what we are talking about in your film is your father and two of his brothers. Father-in-law and his two brothers journeying back to Italy to, in a sense, retrace their steps and, in a sense, to re-experience some of what had unfolded 70 years ago. We're told very briefly of your fourth uncle who died at some point. Did he die during this period or later?
No, the fourth brother died later, actually 20 years ago from a disease. So this is why he's not part of this journey going back. For them, the motivation of going today, 70 years later, and to search this place is mainly because Bubi, the youngest brother, who was only 4 years old back then, he wanted to have a story to tell his children, to tell his grandchildren. And because he was so young, his memories were mixed up with stories that he heard later after the war and stories that he remembered, and everything was kind of a mixture. And he wanted to take the two brothers and to create a new story, one that they can all live peacefully with. So this is so going on this journey for them is trying to get the different stories and different memories they had.
One of the intriguing things about this is the fact that all three of these brothers, your father-in-law and your two uncles, are all intelligent and successful men. And Emmanuel is, at the time of this film, 84. Andreas is 82. And your father is a bit younger than that. But they have all lived long and successful lives. And you can tell that they're brothers. I mean, there is a affectionate bond. But they are also very different from each other. They each have distinctive personalities, and they also have each, in a sense, distinctive ways of looking back at this period in the family's life. Talk for a moment about the differences between these three men.
Yeah, so Emmanuel is a professor of archaeology, anthropology, and philosopher, and he, it's very interesting because he, being kicked out of school when he was 8 years old, I think he made a kind of a mission of life to study as much as he can. And he actually returned to Italy when he was 18 years old, right after there. He already came to Israel after the war, and he returned again to Italy to finish his studies. With the same grade, the same age of children that he was kicked out of. So he finished actually his studies in Italy, and since then being a professor in all kinds of universities around the world. And for him, going to this trip and remembering this time was very, very difficult. He's very heavy physically and mentally, and he's for him it was very he mainly remembered the suffering. He remembers the hunger, the cold. He still wake up in the middle of the night from dreams about this period. It was very, very hard for him, unlike his younger brother Andrea, who is only 2 years apart. Andrea is full of life, very energetic. He's a mountain climber, still is in age 80. Today is already 85, and very optimistic. You know, in the beginning of the film, his first thing that he says that he had fun in the Holocaust, and he's saying that because for him as a kid, it was a very exciting time being with the family in the forest, being in the nature. And it's still, those things are still exciting him also when he's 85. He's a doctor of physics, and every weekend still go to climb on mountains these days. For me, he's like the kid from the Roberto Benigni's film, Life is Beautiful. That kid who grew up, this is Andrea. But he kind of had, you know, a pink glasses, and he saw everything through them. You know, for as a kid, he liked the fact that he's having a quality time with his parents in the forest. He can play being Robin Hood. And of course, his point of view on this period of time makes Emmanuel, his older brother, very annoyed. You know, it's very hard for Emmanuel with his memories and his stories to accept Andrea's way of point of view on the whole story. And then we have the younger brother, Bubi, who is like the peaceman between them, you know, because he didn't have so much memories. He was only, as I said, he was only 4 years old. and is mainly counted counts on what they're saying. And he has to find kind of the balance. He is like the link. He's the balance between the two.
We're speaking with Tamar Dalanati about her film Shalom Italia, which is going to be airing on Monday evening on the PBS series POV. It recounts the story of her father-in-law, Bubi, and his two older brothers, Emmanuel and Andreas, as they journey back to Italy and revisit this really frightening period in their family's history, in which they are, in effect, running from the Nazis and fleeing for their very lives. And Tamara Talanati, explain what was at the heart of your father-in-law's hunger to go back to Italy. What was most important to him? Why was this so important to him? What was it about the intensity of his wishes that compelled his two older brothers to be willing to accompany him on this long and sometimes difficult journey back to Italy?
Yeah, I have to say that Bubi really tried to convince his older brother, Emmanuel, to join this trip, because Emmanuel didn't want to remember this whole period. He didn't want to see these places. He didn't think it's important for the rest of his life to know where it was, this cave, because when they went out to this journey, it was not very clear what they're searching and what exactly is the area. And it was there was a lot of question marks about how will they see where is this place, and will they find anything to recognize. We're talking about, you know, searching in a forest, and it's been 70 years. Of course, nature is really changing, so there was a lot of question marks about what they exactly will find there. And for Bubi, it was very important, because when he was asked about his history, he always answered, "Oh, you should ask Andrea or Emmanuel. I have no idea." He didn't have a story, and for him, it was very important to understand where he came from and how did these first 4 years look like for him. And this is why he was very motivated to convince Emmanuel and Andrea. Andrea, of course, is always saying yes to anything you ask him, so it was not a problem to convince him to join to this trip. But once he got Emmanuel to say yes and come, he immediately arranged the whole thing, and also not only about finding this place or searching for this place. It was mainly about the fact that three men at the age of around 80s go on a journey alone, just the men, no wives, no children, no grandchildren. And that was a very unique opportunity for them. And it's interesting to see also in the film that the dynamics between them and the relationship between them kind of you can really see how they acted when they were children, because these dynamics get them to be children again.
Right. I was just going to say, we get some of that sense that this is probably what they were like when they were 10 and 8 and 4 or whatever their ages respectively would have been. One of the things that's remarkable about the film is that it feels completely candid. That is, we never have a sense, and ever do we have a sense, that they are somehow performing for a camera. They do not seem ever to be self-conscious of the fact that somebody is right there filming their every move, recording their every word. It feels incredibly natural. I wonder, first of all, for you, and you mentioned that there was a cinematographer also on hand for to capture all that we see in this film. What did you do in terms of being present? I mean, did you try to be like the proverbial fly on the wall, never saying a word, never contributing to these conversations? I mean, we never ever hear a single word from you in this film. It is solely about these three brothers. Was it sort of literally that way? I mean, after a while, did they forget that you were even there? Otherwise, how did you manage to capture this as authentically as you did?
Okay, yeah, so it's exactly like you said. It was really being a fly on the wall, and because it was such an intensive journey, we were almost always shooting. It was no, because they're always have something to say. They always argue. They always say something smart or deep. So it, mainly we were always with the camera on. And I try to not to be in their even view, you know, that they cannot really talk to me or a lot of the situation, we even, for instance, the scenes in the kitchen where they argue about who is going to slice the mozzarella, who is going to cut the bread, and they have like very funny arguments. some of these scenes we just left the camera on a tripod because I realized it's getting very intensive with the arguing, so we just left the room. So a lot of the situation, they were really not they didn't care about the camera, they didn't care about they were not they didn't think about whether it's on or off, because there are such person people that they don't care about. They're very authentic anyway. They say what they want always. They don't think about how it will be. They're just very straightforward people. And it's, you know, I'm doing now a documentary series about 18 years old girls who are about to go to the to become a pilot in the Israeli Air Force, and it's such a different to a big difference in shooting a 18 years old girl than shooting an 80 years old man, because the girls, the young girls, are so much aware of the cameras and are so much aware of how they look and what they say and how they talk. And it's really, you know, it's tiring. And damn, it was so nice because you don't have to do anything. You just put the camera on and you know, and they're just being themselves. And they're so much, they're so, you know, when they talk about culture, they talk about philosophy, they talk about history. Everything is always so complex and deep and authentic, which is something that I really miss when I'm shooting 18 years old girls. sweet as they are, I think generation will lose their authenticity. And so this is why you notice this very strong feeling of they're real. And this is because this is who they are.
Absolutely. It's one of the best things about it. One very intriguing moment in the film is, I think, an example of where this is about more than just pointing the camera and then just recording whatever happens. Because in a sense, that feels like something that any of us could do, that this could just be home movies. But this film is much more than just home movies. You've also crafted it, constructed it in such a way that it is so compelling. One of my favorite moments is when we first hear the brothers recalling those days of deprivation back during the Second World War, when they are on the run and at one point, of course, hiding in the woods in this cave. And they talk about how terribly hungry they were, and the kind of food they were forced to eat, and how for long periods of time there was barely anything to eat as well. And the very next thing we see is the three brothers on a shopping trip. Tell our listeners what they are shopping for, and I and the juxtaposition of those two. I think it's a brilliant moment.
Yeah, I mean, the three of the brother are very much Italians. I mean, they hold the Italian mentality, which is, of course, the love for food, the love for eating, the love for cooking. And they, I think, through this journey and through the shooting of the film, I realized how much they connect through food. and talking about food and planning the next meal. That was the moments that I felt that the love is in the air, you know, between them. So in this film, I constructed a line of dealing with food, with cooking, with shopping for food. So right after, it's a great moment when Emmanuel is talking about the hunger and the minimum of food they had per day. And he's talking about salty fishes that they used to get a small piece for each one.
Oh, yes, the sardines.
The sardines, exactly. And then right after that, Booby saying, that's very weird because I hate sardines. I never eat sardines. I'm allergic to sardines or something like that. And so that moment for me is one of the greatest moments as a documentary filmmaker, because in that moment you can really see how memory arises, how memory function. Because once he's saying sardine, that moment on camera, Booby realized why he hates sardines, why his whole life he was being allergic, didn't want to smell it even, because he had such a and until that moment he didn't know the fact that when he was 4 years old, this is all he had to eat for days.
And so we see that moment of realization, the first time in his life that he understood his intense aversion to sardines. You're right. It's a filmmaker's dream, and you were there to capture it. I want to mention another very intriguing moment. This film is not only about these three brothers journeying back to Italy to try to find this cave out in the woods someplace, this all but impossible quest. It is also a trip which allows them to reconnect with a family that had made a difference in them being safe. And we actually see the moment when they are reunited with some of these people who can remember back to what occurred. It's a very touching moment in the film, but it's also really interesting how differently the three brothers think about this family, particularly before they all get together. Can you just say a word, first of all, about this family that they visit? What did they do on behalf of your father-in-law's family way back when? And then say a word about the real different views that your uncles had about what this family had actually done or how much they had done for them.
So the family they meet in the village is a 94 years old woman who her uncle was one of the people who helped them create the first hiding place in the forest. And Booby meets this woman, and she tells him the whole story, and he goes to Andrea and Emmanuel and tell them about the story, and Emmanuel just doubts everything. He don't think the story is true, and he thinks that it's a mythological story that the village invented by themselves. And so Booby insists that they should come and meet this woman. And all through the way in the car going to this woman, Emmanuel just doubts and doubts and doubts. And then when they arrive to her, suddenly when he entered this the house of this woman, and she's saying to him all kinds of sentences like, I remember you going with the stroller with the small boy, of course Booby back then, and she started saying certain stories that you can really see on Emmanuel's face that something is changing in his mind. And this is another great moment for a filmmaker. You can really capture there how the memory changed from the car on the way to the meeting and then sitting there in the house of this woman. And the things that she's telling him really shape his memory. And then for the first time, he's saying to her, I have suppressed these memories for 70 years because it was so hard to remember. And now I realize that your family was the light in this terrible period. And it's really interesting to see that he allow himself to think of old memories that he really suppressed. And that's, for me, it's the most inspiring thing about this film, is about you can really understand how we deal with our memories, how we shape them, how we treat them, how they can be, you know, just like liquid, you know?
Very well put. And of course, it's also so true that it's often a matter of what we allow ourselves to remember, and that if remembering something puts us in touch with terrible pain or terrible fear, then we often make the choice without even realizing we've made the choice to keep all of that at arm's length. And so that's why Emmanuel looks at this family earlier quite dispassionately, just not allowing himself to feel anything of what they really did for them. And I think it's really interesting at one point when he's kind of explaining how he remembers it, and essentially what he says is, I don't know that they did anything so good for us. They just didn't turn us in. In other words, that's the narrative he has chosen to construct. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense to him. It's the way in which he can remember this period without experiencing too much anguish. And the fact that he was the oldest of these three brothers means that it makes perfect sense that this would be such a painful time for him. He probably had so much more awareness,
exactly,
of the danger they were facing than the younger two, for whom this was, at least to some extent, an exciting journey,
exactly,
or adventure.
I think he also really understood what the parents are going through, and he took on himself a lot of that responsibility of taking care of his younger brothers.
I have a last question for you. Of course, at the heart of this journey back to Italy is the search that the brothers are engaged in to try to find this cave, and it was like a man-made cave, we should say, something that they think their father actually built out of rocks out in the dense woods, so the family could be hidden away and not discovered. And they are, Bubi, your father-in-law especially, is just desperate to try to find this cave again. We won't give away whether or not they are able to find this cave. We will leave it to our listeners to watch the film and find that out for themselves. But it's clear right from the start that this is an all but hopeless cause. The possibility of finding this remote cave in this dense forest again after all these years is, the chance of them finding it is so slim. And here we're talking about three elderly men making their way through this thick forest. I'm curious if you and your cinematographer were tempted at all to try to really help them in this search. The sense we get is that you didn't, that you just had your camera there to capture their desperate and largely unsuccessful efforts. Is that the way it unfolded? And if so, how hard was it for you to not try to engage in the search yourself and help them find this cave that they were so eager to find?
I have to say that the first day we entered that forest, I told the cinematographer, okay, this is crazy. I mean, this is, you look around yourself 360 degrees and by a minute you're lost, because it's so hard to get orientation there. Everything looks the same everywhere you look, and it's just such a huge forest. So the first day I was, okay, no way they're going to find it. And it's not about me helping them. It's about, this is a mission impossible. So it was not even about trying to find it. It was really about understanding and looking on them to see each one of them, how they are interested in this search or not. And it was very funny with Emmanuel, the older brother, when we came back in the first day after it was, we realized how complicated it's going to be. He said, you know what, maybe it's better for your film if we would not find the cave, because then it will be, you know, it wouldn't be like, he said, it wouldn't be like an American film, like a happy, good end, and it would be more complicated. It would be, so you can really see, and Andrea, of course, he said, no, we have to find it. It's not going to be a good film if we won't find it. So each one of them, you know, with his point of view on the whole story and point of view of life, had a different, even for the film, had a different way of thinking. So it was interesting to see, you know, that in the end, Andrea really wants to find it, and Emmanuel will also live good without finding this place. So it was it made the whole journey more exciting. Because you can really feel the both of them having totally different wishes.
Absolutely. And at the very end of the film, a line from one of the three men, I'm trying to remember who.
Emmanuel.
Who says, we are made of memory. And, of course, you and along with us as we watch the film, probably learned that along the way, all of the different ways in which that is true.
Yes. It's for me, it's an interesting point of view of Emmanuel, because he's saying that we are made of memory, and the sentence that he's saying just before is referring to the Holocaust and World War II. As a small dot in a wide of thousands of years of memory. And being a Holocaust survivor, saying, you know, Holocaust is just one piece of who we are, of life, of thousands of years of living. I think it's very, you don't hear a lot of this way of thinking from Holocaust survivor, because usually Holocaust survivor, the Holocaust memory is the thing that, you know, color all of their life. That event will affected the whole of the life. And here we have a Holocaust survivor saying, this is just one part of me, of who we are, and of thousands of years of memories that we are made of. So we're not made, as he's saying, we're not made of only the memories in this life. We're made of thousands of memories in this world.
Well, we can experience all this and more in your marvelous film, again called Shalom Italia, the journey of these three Jewish brothers back to Italy to revisit this chapter from their distant lives, their childhood, and coming back to a very different time and place, and a film that shares with us so many intriguing thoughts about what family means, what memory means, it's a beautiful film start to finish. It airs on Monday night as part of the PBS series POV, and the filmmaker responsible for it, Tamar Tal Anati. Tamar Tal Anati, thank you so much for bringing this film to the world and for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was a great pleasure for me to speak with you.
Same for me. Thank you so much.
And it's 11 minutes before 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out today's program, I want to play for you another excerpt from an interview which I recorded this past Sunday evening with Mike Johnson, who happens to be one of the co-owners of The Dry Guys, which is a local business that that does repair of water damage, among other services that they provide. I had talked to Mike Johnson a few months earlier while he was out on the East Coast helping with the cleanup efforts in the wake of Hurricane Sandy. And I thought it would be interesting to connect with him and talk about the work which he and some of his employees have been doing here in southeastern Wisconsin in the wake of our own flooding. At the time that we recorded this interview on Sunday night, Mike had not yet done much work in the Burlington area, which, of course, sustained the most serious flood damage. And I want to air this last portion of our conversation in anticipation of some very heavy rainfall that is anticipated to move into our area late this afternoon and into this evening, which could stir still more flooding here in southeastern Wisconsin. Here's a portion of my conversation again with Mike Johnson.
Mike, one more question. One of the things that is especially disturbing about these situations is that in the wake of a big flood or in the wake of a big hailstorm or whatever it might be, one of the things that often happens is that you have people flocking to the area from who knows where, offering their services, but often at jacked up prices, and maybe not in a position to back up their work or not being fully trustworthy. I suspect that that's a very direct concern for you, and whether people call the Dry Guys or some other local firm, I suspect that you would really encourage people, if at all possible, to try to reach out to someone who is a trusted part of the community.
Yeah, we've dealt with that on different trips that we've taken. That you know, people have come into areas and you know, they go in there and they take a deposit from a homeowner, and then they're gone. You know, so. That's something that, you know, every community faces. There's, unfortunately, there's people out there that are taking advantage of a situation like this. So to make sure that you are working with a reputable company, not only that has been around and, you know, they're trustworthy, but also the work that they do, you know, they're certified people that know how to properly clean and dry out a house, because it's one thing to go in there and dry out a house. It's one thing to dry out a house. Sorry, Greg. Can we revisit that?
Sure, sure. You want me to pose? One of the sad realities in the wake of a flood like this or a bad hailstorm or whatever it might be is that we often see people streaming into the area from who knows where, offering services, offering help, but often at jacked up prices, sometimes preposterously high prices. And in many cases, not being able to back up their work, in some cases, not even properly equipped to do the work. But people can often feel so desperate for help that they will reach out to these complete strangers who have flocked in to take advantage of the situation. I suspect that you would encourage people, whether or not they're calling your firm or a firm like it, but one way or another, if at all possible, for people to reach out to a trustworthy firm who is part of the community in order to really receive the proper kind of help.
Right. And unfortunately, Greg, there are people that take advantage of, you know, situations like this, and we've seen it with the different trips that we've taken, companies that are coming in from outside of the town, and you know, they've taken deposits and you know, taken off with the money for the work that they're supposed to do. And I think it's critical that each person does their research and into, you know, the company that they're going to work with, that they work with a reputable company, and using maybe word of mouth, friend and family, to know that the company that they're working with is a reputable company, or simply doing the research and be sure that the company that they're going to work with has a good reputation. They're going to do a good job.
I appreciate the sincerity with which you want to help people, and I'm sure it's in a sense gratifying for you to be able to make a difference in people's lives. And at the same time, I know you well enough to know that it probably deeply grieves you that that your help is necessary on such a widespread scale. I'm sure this is in many respects a painful time for you and other people who do the work that you do.
Yeah, it's always sad when you come into a home and you see all the contents and devastation in someone's home, and you feel horrible that they have to go through something like this. I mean, our job is to try and take something devastating like that and somehow try and turn it to a positive, you know, just through comforting that homeowner. This is what we do. I mean, we restore homes all the time, and to help them get through this process the best way we can, just with you know, showing some empathy and make sure we're taking care of their personal effects and trying to salvage as much as we can, and making this event as painless as possible for them.
Mike Johnson is one of the owners of the Dry Guys. Mike, in this very, very busy time for you and all of your employees, I appreciate you taking a few minutes out of your schedule to talk about this situation here in southeastern Wisconsin, a situation that we're happy to say is slowly but surely turning around, and we appreciate the good work that you and other firms like yours are doing in order to enable this cleanup to continue. Best wishes. Stay safe out there.
Well, thank you, Greg. Appreciate it, and thank you for your time.
And we'll be updating you in the weather forecast in just a moment. Let's look ahead to the morning shows coming up next week. On Monday, we'll be talking politics with Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College, talking about the difficulty the Republicans are having in repealing and replacing the Affordable Health Care Act, and the ongoing investigation between the Trump administration and Russia, and also some of the challenging choices facing Democrats, looking ahead to the next midterm elections and trying to build on the recent political reversals that the party has suffered across the country. So that'll be on Monday's morning show. On Tuesday, my conversation with the author of a book called Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? A look at why we focus on gender so much in this country. And the author poses some intriguing questions on whether or not we need to even be asking about gender on things like a driver's license. On Wednesday, Nancy Davies, who was a publicist for Ringling Brothers, she has been spending the last few days, or is about to spend this weekend, at Baraboo for a huge reunion involving employees from Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey Circus. Of course, Ringling Brothers is about to bring down the curtain on their operations, and so this is a very poignant reunion and homecoming of sorts. And she's going to tell us all about it on Wednesday's morning show. Next Thursday, Dr. Art Sear joins us to give us his analysis on current events here and around the world. Nicole Thompson from Downtown Kenosha Incorporated joins me on the program. Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andreas, a Kenosha